Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. I'm Tammy Charwell, the Executive Director of Aspen Public Radio. What a perfect day to be here in Aspen, and we're so excited that you're all here. Thank you so very much. I want to first thank Alpine Bank of Aspen for sponsoring this event. Thank you so very much. We really appreciate it. We know you're an important part of the community. Thank you. So we have a great conversation for you all this afternoon with Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. And he, unfortunately, is a little bit delayed from ideas, but he will be here shortly. But what we will do, I think it's really interesting to talk to the 1A producer. Rupert Allman will have a little bit of a conversation with Kristen Kay to give you some behind the scenes until Joshua gets here. So I'm really excited about that. Of course, 1A airs 9 to 11 a.m. here on Aspen Public Radio. Great show, amazing show. We're so proud to be able to bring it to you. If you are a member of Aspen Public Radio, thank you so much. If you are not, please consider supporting Aspen Public Radio so we can continue to bring you great programs like 1A and events like this and reporting right here in Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley. We have a new e-newsletter, if you're not aware. It's called The Transmitter. You can sign up for it on our website. Comes to you once a week, and you'll learn about events like this and great stories that our reporters are working on and connections in the community. So right now, I would like to introduce Aspen Public Radio arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay. And we also have Rupert Allman from 1A. Thank you for coming, everyone.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kristen Kay from Aspen Public Radio. As Tammy mentioned, we'll first be speaking with Rupert Allman. He's the executive producer of 1A, and he's going to pull back the curtain on that show and give us a glimpse behind the scenes. So, Rupert, first of all, welcome back.
Thank you. I shall make it clear that I am entirely responsible for Joshua's delay. We can go into some secret details in a minute, but it's one of the exciting things about coming to do this wonderful week. It is full of surprises. Some are unexpected, obviously, as surprises go, but at some point in the next hour, I'm expecting Joshua to charge through the back of this lawn and do what he does best. So it's lovely to see you, and thanks for hosting us this week. It's been a pleasure.
So the first time that you came to have a picnic on the lawn with our Aspen Public Radio listeners was 2 years ago, and 1A had only existed for about 6 months. So first of all, I want to hear about the search for a host for 1A and how Joshua Johnson was eventually chosen.
Well, for those with longer memories, you'll know that the program that we kind of inherited was hosted by someone called Diane Rehm. Diane obviously was a legend. Yeah, absolutely. She did some fantastic things for our business. She did wonderful things for the place of women in public media. But she had done her program for 37 years. And she thought it was time after the election to just take it a bit easier. And she was 81. And she had decided at that point it was time to kind of go on and do other things. Interestingly, one of the things she did go on to was to remarry, which she did a year later. But either way, she kind of paved the way for us to be able to launch a new program. And you're right, so we've been going 2.5 years. To find the host, we put our audience through quite a trial. Some of you, you know, may have heard all sorts of various people. Some you'll know from NPR, some you wouldn't have known from NPR, some you liked, some you didn't. And we ran that process for about 2 months, and the very last person to audition, if you like, on Diane's old show was Joshua. I had met him when I was working in New York. He was working on a particular project, and I thought, yes, guy's got something. And he came over, and he blew it out of the water. Everyone thought, who is this guy? And it really kind of put him on the radar for us. And I'll be candid with you, I think one of the reasons why it surprised us is because we kind of defaulted to the idea that we were going to obviously find a new show with a new host, but it was probably going to be a new woman, because it just kind of would make sense in terms of what Diane had contributed. And, you know, Joshua was the only guy on the final shortlist of about three or four. But in the end, I think the response to him was so warm. Diane, too, was someone who was so impressed with him that we decided, right, okay, we'll take a risk and do something new. So when we first arrived a few years ago, we'd only been doing the show 6 months or so. We were far too excited. We were doing far too many things. And hopefully since then, we've calmed down a bit.
I want to talk about that. How has the show evolved in the past 2.5 years?
I think the program has grown, and we're thankful for the growth because folks like you have been able to contribute to stations like Aspen Public Radio. That brings in the money, that helps us kind of make the case and build the program and start new projects. So in fact, we've kind of doubled the audience that Diane had in the first 2 years, which is exciting. It also means we were able to do new things which allowed people in other parts of the country to hear the program. Predominantly, if you were listening to Diane's show, you had to listen kind of really on sort of Central Time or Eastern Time. We now have a version of the program which you can hear any time of day, and quite a lot of kind of West Coast Californian stations now take a program which is a slightly updated version of what we do every day, and they put it on. So Joshua, whether you're driving in Los Angeles or San Francisco or wherever it is, you'll hear him at various times of the day. The one thing you'll never hear people on our program say is good morning. And we kind of have to beat it into them because at some point the program is going to air in the afternoon or in the evening or something like that. So that's one of the things we kind of prime people with. But yeah, as I say, it's been fantastic. The growth has been wonderful. And this week is genuinely one of our most favorite weeks. It's a fabulous place to come. We're received so warmly. And obviously, we meet any number of really interesting people, as you can imagine, for the festival. But also, it's turned into something where we're kind of also playing a part in the festival as well. So Joshua tomorrow is hosting a couple of panels. He's been on a few panels. He was doing something this morning. And here's the secret. So he's not here, and you're having to listen to this burbling Englishman, because unexpectedly, Mark Zuckerberg turned up to speak to the festival this afternoon. He wasn't part of the agenda, and we didn't expect him to arrive. So nor did I expect Joshua to have an invite to meet the big man in person. And that doesn't happen very often. So he's kind of wrapping that up now, and I hope you'll forgive me. Not that anyone here is any more or less important than Mark Zuckerberg, but it's an opportunity for Joshua to meet someone in person that he wouldn't necessarily get.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about throwing the plan out the window. We have not just a 24-hour news cycle, but policy decisions that are announced via Twitter now. And so I'm wondering about a time when you had a perfect, well-planned-out show that you had to throw out at the last minute because of a tweet from President Trump or because of breaking news.
I'm going to single out Paige, who's the producer in the corner here. And I'm going to feel her pain. Paige said to me earlier today that I think she'd counted at least 6 or 8 shows she had to completely blow up in the space of a few hours, usually tied to a world event or a tweet. And it does happen more often than we like, I think, because we have to be careful about what we're throwing out before we know what we're going to put in. The last time, we didn't blow up the entire show, but just to give you a point of how often it can happen, we struggle with particularly with the president, in terms of what I call the signal-to-noise ratio. There's a lot of noise. And our job, I think, is, and hopefully you trust us to do it, is to kind of pick out what really is worth paying attention to. So about 3 weeks ago, we had a program, I don't know what it was, sorry, but we had a program ready to go, and it was the time when the president had given an interview to George on ABC News. I don't know if you remember that one. And at the time, he said on the Sunday that if someone had come to him with dirt from a foreign government, would he look at it? And he said, I'd take a look. He then decided to change his mind and wrote back on that. But at that particular time, it was a Monday morning. It was one of those things where actually that wasn't just a kind of casual throwaway remark from the president. That was that was something which bared scrutiny. So as a result, that's the kind of thing where we end up having to just, you know, tear up or adjust what we do on the hoof. But I'm really mindful of the idea that I would hope that a lot of people who listen to NPR and public media in general, they come to us because they know we're not cable news and we're not just following every little tweet and TikTok that happens without differentiating what is important and what just seems to be noise. So Paige, I'm sorry about blowing up the shows, but it does happen from time to time.
I want to talk about what you just mentioned, which is the mission of the show, not to be like cable news. What was a show or a moment in the past 2.5 years where you were like, that's it, that's our purpose?
I know exactly when it was, and it's interesting because you could ask Joshua exactly the same question, you'll get a very different answer.
I was going to.
Okay, good. We have been fairly mobile, and we do kind of get around the country. One of the station trips we had about 6 months, 8 months ago was to New Hampshire. And the issue we were talking about was labor shortages. And in the fact that when the economy's good, a lot of communities are just struggling to find workers, either because they're moving out of the area, and New Hampshire was really struggling with this. And in particular, certain trades. And one of the guests we had on was a local welder. And he was really sort of talking about the fact that he wanted, but was struggling to find people to come into the industry and train to be a welder. And Joshua had said, well, you know, it just feels that there are so many other opportunities now. This is, you know, something which feels a little 20th century as opposed to the new jobs of the 21st century. Make your case for someone to be a welder. And he said, well, it's really simple for me. Every time I drive into Boston and I see the skyline there, that's my canvas. That's what I see that I have built. I know what's gone into that building. I know how that rivet went in. For me, that's the lasting legacy that I have. And it was a real fantastic takeaway to see someone interpret their industry in that kind of way, in a way actually that had some lasting impact. So much of what we do, I mean, radio, it's gone. That's it. But here was someone who was saying, every time I drive into Boston, there I see the skyline, and that's what my legacy is. And if you're about building things and leaving your mark, then be a welder.
I want to talk about the evolution of radio a little bit and what 1A is doing. 1A covers current events, of course. The Friday News Roundup is, the podcast is kind of my treat when I'm going on a hike or a bike ride on the weekend. But it's so much more than just a show about politics or current events. It covers everything from how drag is becoming more mainstream to preventing workplace shootings to forgiveness after the massacre in Charleston 4 years ago. But no matter the topic, 1A has a couple of experts. But it also weaves together so many other voices and perspectives from the audience, mainly in the form of tweets or voice memos or voicemails. Why bring in all those different perspectives? Why not just stick to the experts or take live calls from people who are listening to their radio during the 2 hours the show is on?
So working backwards, one of the reasons we don't not do the live calls anymore, we do occasionally, but we don't default to live calls. And the reason for that is pretty simple. There's only a certain number of people who can call in live to the program, who are listening live to the program, and they tend to be from a certain kind of limited, I'm gonna say this politely, social pool. And they're also in a certain part of the country. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to pull in all perspectives from all manner of places, knowing that people are listening to what we do at all times of day. Sometimes, I mean, most, you know, my kids, they don't have a radio, they've got a phone. And so they'll just pick up the phone and listen when they want to listen. So the engagement that we do on the program is very intentional. And so when we built the program, we were going to move away from what I call a classic call-in show. They're fantastic, they exist, they're never going to go away. But what we wanted to do is basically take advantage of the idea that the audiences now interact and engage with us in like a myriad of ways, usually through their phone. Some just prefer to text. Some people want to leave a message through an app. Some people want to be part of a text club. Some people just prefer to email. Other people just want to be on social media. Some people want to do it behind the cloak of anonymity. Some people want to put their name to it. And a call-in show is pretty agricultural. It's a phone. That's it. And the way we all talk to our families now, we all lean on any number of these different platforms. And what we just really wanted to do was just reflect how we created the show using these platforms. The other key driver for me was the fact that we like to, it's been described by Joshua as co-author the program. And to your point about how we don't just only rely on experts, well, there's the power of testimony. You'll constantly hear us on the program talk about share what you know, not tell us what you think, share what you know. We're looking for people to share their lived experiences so we can learn from them, because the audience is fantastic. They're our greatest asset. And if they're willing to share stories, sometimes so personal, that is the real gold for us. That will help us drive our conversation in certain ways, in the ways that maybe we didn't expect. But as I say, every conversation feels a little different. We have a different kind of kit of parts to put into it. Sometimes it's just a straightforward one-on-one, you know? There'll be times when we take on a particular subject and we know it's kind of pretty niche, so chances are we don't have that many people in the audience who know a huge amount of this particular story. Others, when it's about, you know, for example, we did a story recently about miscarriages, or we did a story about kind of, you know, whether particularly stories around identity, they're huge kind of, you know, places where people want to share their stories.
I want to talk about the process of developing trust with your audience, because people call in that pregnancy loss episode, a huge variety of people called in to talk about one of the most private and painful moments of their life. What has that been like? How has the show developed trust with its audience so people feel comfortable sharing that?
I won't take any credit for this. I think the reason why we're able to have those moments is because NPR has been going for nearly 50 years. And for 50 years, the people who've supported it, who've invested in it, who listen, they're the people who have basically given this institution a moment of trust. I mean, you wouldn't have known Joshua or 1A from Adam or Eve 2 years ago, but you trust public radio. And I think it's such an important question, because it's one of those things that, man, you've got to hang on to it, because once you lose it, you can't get it back. And I think it's because public radio, over the decades, has been seen as a trusted, civil, sincere space where if you do contribute, you are going to be respected. You're not going to be taken out of turn, that people feel willing to share, you know, those stories.
1A broadcasts from a lot of different stations all over America. You were in Greeley, Colorado, not too long ago this spring, and why take the show on the road as much as you do?
Part of it is that we're a national conversation, and we're very sensitive about the idea that we're produced in Washington, D.C., and it won't take me to tell you that if you live there for too long, you see the world in a particular way. And so it's really important that you get yourself out of the bubble and out of the beltway. You know, Joshua's very strong on this, and when he does come bounding across the lawn, he can tell you a little bit about his own philosophy. You know, a boy from kind of, you know, West Palm in Florida, worked in San Francisco, so his sensibility of this country is not D.C. It really isn't, and I hope when we do the program, we don't come across as too D.C., because that would be just terrible. By the way, if you do have questions about Joshua, now is the time to get it in, because I could probably give you an answer that he won't tell you, okay? So put your hand up if you want a question about what it's like to work with Joshua Johnson. Going back to that thing about why we go around the country, we've actually launched a 2-year project called Across America, and what we'd wanted to do, this is a reflection on what happened in 2016. There was a conversation in the media about what did the media miss about 2016, and can we make steps to make sure that we don't trip ourselves up in the same way? And I have often described political coverage at campaign time in America as watching young children of kindergarten age play soccer. They all kind of congregate around the same ball, and there are huge parts of the country that don't get a look in because they're just deemed to be electorally boring. And so this project that we have And to be fair to our partner stations, I wouldn't want it to get out that, you know, their name was electorally boring. But they're not Ohio. They're not Pennsylvania. It's not Florida. They are places where we're intentionally going because people have got stories to tell, but they don't necessarily figure highly in the electoral college. Colorado's is a bit of an exception. It's got that wonderful purple status. The Greeley, Colorado episode was because we wanted to explore this fantastic debate that's going on over oil and gas at the moment. You'll know yourself if you drive through that part of the country just what's going on there and how it's changing the area. And that was a very live debate. Now, that conversation was such a different conversation when we had it in Greeley than the one that we would have had in Washington, D.C. with any number of kind of lobbyists and flacks. These were people whose livelihoods and their families depended on the industry. At the same time, we had people whose families butted up against some of these new rigs, or the schools were close to it, and they had concerns about the health, kind of sort of care for their kids and things like that. So we're pretty mobile, but most of it's just the idea that I think if you're a national program, you have to be heard nationally, and it's not the hardest place to come to Aspen to do that.
What is the show thinking about? What's in your heads as the next election approaches?
I think what is crucial for us as program makers is to figure out ways that we feel that we can listen much more closely to what our audience is telling us. Not to be slaves to looking at your screens. There's CNN, there's MSNBC, and there's Fox, and somehow, because they're all doing the same story, it's somehow important. CNN, cable news, have their place, but they don't get to decide the programs you hear on NPR. It's a different editorial agenda. And so I think if hopefully in the next coming, in the, this year and in the coming months and things like that, we are spending more time listening to what our audience is telling us, then we'll be more true to reflecting the conversations and the guests that people want to speak to. One thing which I think is really important, and I do think Joshua does a good job of it, is I think sometimes media can just be very kind of, it's Anderson speaking to so-and-so, and it's Christian Amanpour speaking to such and such. I think 1A's kind of USP, if you like, is that when we do get a guest in who's running for office or wants some kind of position of power, we give you an opportunity to get your questions in and to make sure that that kind of is what's driving the interview. It's not, you know, sort of people trading off in terms of, you know, arguing about a particular point. We try and open it up as much as we can to the audience. So I think the transparency piece is going to be interesting. What happens between now and next November, God only knows. I mean, it could go in any number of places, and anyone who would make a prediction is a fool. So I'm not going to.
Well, I think my last question will be, before Joshua Johnson gets here, is what's it like to work with Joshua Johnson? Like, you can give us a little dirt.
Joshua, you'll find out for yourself in a few minutes' time. He's a kind of an unstoppable force to a certain extent. Just to kind of big him up, because I do think it's one of those things where you think, yeah, you just go on the radio and talk. Doesn't take much. How easy can that be to do? And more pretty, I mean, to remind, but also that Diane was doing this as well, to do 2 hours of live radio on any number of things that we throw at him. I mean, we throw everything at him in terms of either it's breaking news, or it's a story which is deeply personal, or it's something he knows nothing about. We've got a fabulous team, of course, who support him, but you've got to be ready to ride the roller coaster and go with it. And he keeps us on our toes, as you know, with hosts. You know, there are demands. The demands are legitimate because, you know, he's at the, what I call, the tip of the spear. So we need to make sure our facts are right, the guests are great, they've been prepped, and he knows what direction of travel we're going on with that. But he's, you know, he is kind of someone who, as I said, going back to that idea when we first heard from him when he was auditioning on the old show, he's kind of someone who will tell you that from the age of 5, this is what he wanted to do. He used to go around and interview his family at the age of 5 with a stick. I mean, yeah. And he finds kind of radio and the TV business magical. And I think the other thing which impresses me when I work with him is I've actually found very few people who advocate for our business as articulately and as passionately as he does. You know, to a certain extent, sometimes you can see kind of public radio in one guard where it's like, well, it's nice, it's fuzzy, it's good, you know, people like it. But it should be bigger. It should be more successful. It should be heard by more people. It should have a really important space in our national dialogue. And again, can I come back to the idea that I thank you all for being part of that and supporting it and supporting this community as well. But it's still really relatively unknown. And it doesn't get the credit I think it deserves because TV is a lot of noise and they've got a lot of money. And for example, just going back the other day to some of the commentary that gets around about what stories do and don't get covered, you can guarantee that NPR is on it, and they do report on it, and they do go out of their way to ask the right questions. And it may not just get the attention it deserves because it's not the bright, shiny ball of cable news. But working with Joshua, it kind of brought home to me, the reason why you go into this business anyway is because you think you're doing something of value, and it's kind of appreciated. And even Paige and I were just looking at some tweets that we always get into the program and stuff like that. If we can reach one person who either needed some help or advice on a particular story, then it makes it all the worthwhile. And Joshua's ability to kind of reach through the speaker and kind of engage with you is a rare talent. So if anyone tells you that, you know, you just have to turn up and talk for a couple of hours, that's easy. In our business, there aren't any records. It's very demanding. And on top of that, of course, I kind of, you know, I drag him around the country and ask him to do, you know, all these kind of things and meet Zuckerberg and come and talk to you and things like that. But he's a great character. He's a great character. And I just apologize that he's just a little bit late today.
Well, thanks so much to Rupert Allman, the executive producer of 1A. Thank you.
Short pause, and then Joshua will come and do part two.
Don't go anywhere. Joshua Johnson will be here in just a few minutes. We'll take an intermission until then. Thank you so much for your patience. Mm-hmm.